From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. For three decades, conspiracy theorists have obsessed over who killed JFK. On today's Fresh Air, Pulitzer Prize-winning writer Norman Mailer examines the life of assassin Lee Harvey Oswald. Mailer has written a new book called Oswald's Tale, an American Mystery. Mailer says he wanted this book to give Oswald a deep enough character, the kind you would find in a novel, so that the reader can assess whether Oswald was capable of masterminding the killing. Also today, Cagney and Lacey are together again in a new made-for-TV movie. We'll talk with actresses Tyne Daly and Sharon Glass about their starring roles in the 80s TV series about two women cops. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Rescue workers in Oklahoma City have pulled 11 more bodies from the wreckage of the federal building. The death toll is now 110. Eight of the bodies were found in an area that the firefighters call the pit. That's where several floors were pancaked on top of the daycare center and social security area. Fire Chief Gary Marr says most of those areas have been searched.
I believe we've gone through most of the daycare at this point. The Social Security is going to be hard to determine because they're now looking at the situation, how much actually came straight down and how much went what might be considered across or sideways because of the blast. So that may be harder to determine at some point.
Meanwhile, federal authorities are still piecing together bombing suspect Timothy McVeigh's movements in the days leading up to the bombing of the federal building. They're checking along interstate highways for possible drop-off points for the second suspect wanted in connection with the attack. FBI agent in charge, Weldon Kennedy, says they're still looking for him.
I would like to emphasize that we're still attempting to identify and locate the man known as John Doe Number 2. The only description we have is the composite sketch, which has been widely publicized. We urge citizens to consider only that sketch and not any additional descriptive information that may have been reported in news accounts.
A published report today had said federal investigators had a diary alleging bombing suspect McVeigh and others planned simultaneous attacks in Phoenix and Omaha as well as Oklahoma City. But Agent Kennedy and Attorney General Janet Reno say they have no information about any such diary. President Clinton talked today with senior Russian officials about the upcoming U.S.-Russian summit meeting. UPI's Bill Small prepared this report.
Mr. Clinton discussed the upcoming Moscow summit for about 10 minutes with Russian Foreign Minister Kozarev and for a half an hour on the phone with Russian President Yeltsin. But National Security Council official Coit Blacker was unable to indicate any progress on issues still dividing the two.
Stay tuned, I guess, is what I would say. I think we're optimistic about the capacity to move the agenda forward.
Pending issues include Russia's proposed sale of nuclear technology to Iran, the action to the Russian military in Chechnya, and the possible admission of Eastern European nations to NATO. Bill Small at the White House.
A 19-year-old man has pleaded guilty to first-degree murder in the slaying of basketball star Michael Jordan's father. Larry Demery has agreed to testify against his co-defendant. He still could be sentenced to death. He faces a minimum sentence of life in prison. Demery has pleaded guilty to robbery, weapons violations, and other charges. James Jordan was shot on July 23, 1993, as he napped in his car on an isolated highway. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 14 points at 43.14. This is NPR. The Justice Department is suing to block Microsoft's acquisition of the California-based software company Intuit. The deal would have been the largest software industry merger ever. Ingrid Lobet of member station KPLU in Seattle reports.
Microsoft has wanted to acquire Intuit to gain the popular personal finance program Quicken. The nearly $2 billion merger would help Microsoft get a lead in the financial services market, but the Justice Department says the deal would lead to higher prices and less innovation in financial software. During its inquiry, Justice Department attorneys reportedly had long discussions with Microsoft competitors about the merger's implications for future online services. After a federal judge nixed a Justice Department settlement with Microsoft in another matter. Some analysts were predicting the department would place conditions on the Intuit deal, but fewer believe Justice would sue to block the deal, as it now has. For National Public Radio, I'm Ingrid Lobet in Seattle.
The Pentagon says it's testing two drugs that would allow troops to fight even after being exposed to nuclear radiation. The director of the Defense Nuclear Agency says the drug wouldn't reverse the exposure to radiation and its lethal effects, but it would control nausea and other symptoms of radiation sickness. The drugs have been approved by the Food and Drug Administration. Tests are being done on 24 volunteers at an Air Force base in Texas. The tests are to be finished next year. NATO first became interested in a radiation drug in 1989, but the rush to get it slowed down after the Berlin Wall fell. U.S. and Japanese negotiators have wrapped up 2 days of lower-level talks on car trade. There are few, if any, signs of progress. Both sides have decided not to hold a third day of talks. A Japanese official says there's a possibility talks might resume when trade ministers meet in Vancouver, Canada, early next month. Trade in cars accounts for about 60% of Japan's trade surplus with the U.S. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Norman Mailer has chronicled his times in his works of fiction and nonfiction. He wrote about World War II in The Naked and the Dead, and the movement against the war in Vietnam in Armies of the Night. He gave his take on the women's movement in The Prisoner of Sex, wrote about an American icon in Marilyn, told the story of Killer Gary Gilmore in The Executioner's Song, and the history of the CIA in Harlot's Ghost. In his new book, Mailer takes on the Kennedy assassination by examining the life of Lee Harvey Oswald. It's called Oswald's Tale, an American Mystery. Mailer had access to KGB files in Minsk, where Oswald lived for 2.5 years after he defected to the Soviet Union. Mailer worked on this book with Lawrence Schiller. They also collaborated on The Executioner's Song. Mailer told me what he hoped to achieve in writing about Oswald.
I wanted to do a book that, in which Oswald would be as alive as he would be if he were a good character in a good novel. You know, when we think of people like Anna Karenina or the Joad family in The Grapes of Wrath, or any, I use any number of examples, we have a picture. We understand them. They're people we can see. We can live with them. We can think about them. And I wanted to do that in this book for Oswald and for his wife and for Oswald's mother. Because I felt that once you understand that triangle of forces between these three people, you really would have something that would be interesting, and that then the scenarios could begin. There was no base to the scenarios before this. That was part of the trouble.
Your new Oswald book is based on a lot of research, and I'm wondering why you have chosen to go in a research direction in the past few years while you've been doing this book, as opposed to a totally fiction direction.
Oh, it's what I call rotation of crops. it's writing fiction is so different from investigative journalism that when you go from one to the other, you restore yourself to a degree. After I finished Harlot's Ghost, which is a very long book, it's 1,300 pages, and it was all fiction, I just felt the need to do a book that used another part of myself. And I think it comes down to that. You write one book using one part of yourself, and then while that's recovering and filling up again, you use another part of yourself. I may go back and forth a number of times yet. If I have 3 or 4 more books to write, it's possible that 1 or 2 of them will be investigative journalism.
Where were you when you found out that Kennedy was assassinated?
I was in a restaurant, I don't recall the name, somewhere on the east side, in the east 50s of Manhattan. And I was sitting with a couple of friends. And when I heard it, I was so cynical at the time that I said, oh, he wasn't really hurt. He's faking it to let America realize how much we need him. And you'll see in an hour or two, he's going to be fine. Oh, oh, oh. When you're wrong, you're wrong. And when the news came that he died, I was profoundly shocked because I'd been so cynical an hour before.
Had you admired Kennedy all along?
It wasn't that I admired him. I'd had almost a critical relation to him. I'd written some pretty tough pieces about his actions in Cuba for the Village Voice. I'd made fun of him in pieces. I was angry at him a lot of the time. My feelings toward him were probably about equal to my feelings now for Clinton, as a Democrat, I wasn't altogether happy with him at all. But when he died, I realized that we'd lost something irreplaceable.
Now, did that make you feel bad about things that you'd said about him in print in the past?
To a degree, but, you know, after all, if you're going to criticize people, you criticize them. You can't keep being sorry for everything nasty you've ever said about anyone. Some of the time, you know, if you take away the power of criticism from American life, what are we going to have?
Are you one of the people who actually saw Oswald get shot live on television?
You know, I don't recall any longer. No, in fact, I know definitely I didn't, because I was watching a football game with George Plimpton. Comes back to me now. We were watching the New York Giants, I think, play the St. Louis Cardinals or wherever they were playing, and it came over the loudspeaker system. And what was extraordinary about that is there were 60,000 people in the Polo Grounds at the time, and this incredible, oh, came up from the crowd. When 60,000 people make that sound, you're never going to hear the like again. And, of course, we all looked at each other and said, oh, the whole thing's a conspiracy from beginning to end.
Now, you think that there's a 75% chance, correct me if I have this wrong, a 75% chance that...
Probability, I'd say.
That yeah. Oswald functioned alone.
Well, that's just my estimate of his character is such that I think that he was enormously tempted to commit such an act because it would have resolved so many questions in his life. But it's no more than that. It is a guess. It is a conclusion. It is a speculation. Because I've been living with probabilities for so long, I took that figure 75%.
What did you find in Oswald's character that leaves you to believe that he probably functioned alone?
Well, on the one hand, he wanted to be a great man and a great political leader, and on the other hand, he wanted to have enormous attention for himself and for his ideas. He believed he was special. One of the things that I got from writing the book was that he did not see himself as an ordinary man or a nerd or a little fellow. Far from it. His circumstances might be mean and small, but he saw himself as potentially enormous, as a great leader. One of the reasons Castro was his hero is because Castro had come relatively out of nowhere and become the leader of a country. Oswald saw himself as a future Castro, a future Lenin, a future Mao. He saw himself as a great political leader. He was even fascinated with Hitler, not because he agreed with Hitler's ideas, but because Hitler to him represented a certain parallel to his own life. Hitler had been very poor. Hitler lived in loneliness. Hitler had read a great many books and was self-educated. And so Oswald read Mein Kampf and responded, I believe, to passages in that book. But, of course, Hitler's ideas would have been alien to him because Oswald hated the idea of a fatherland, of super patriotism, of loving one's country. His feeling is he was much more a liberationist, a libertarian. He believed that one should have small groups and live in free association with other people, with a minimum of government. He was totally opposed to both American capitalism and Soviet communism.
Having done all this research into Oswald, what do you think his mental equilibrium was? Do you think he was a sane person? Do you think he was pathological?
No, I think he was absolutely sane. He was sane, but somewhat unbalanced. When you're insane, what happens is that you really misperceive reality in a critically different fashion. If you're eating some food in a restaurant and you say, I think that they may be trying to poison us here, you're in that middle ground between dirty pots and active poisoning, if you follow what I mean. In other words, it's a somewhat unbalanced remark, but it doesn't indicate you're crazy. If you say these radishes are growing rhubarb, then you're insane. You follow me on this?
I think so. That one has like no grounds in reality at all. One.
Yeah. Or
one is pure hallucination, and the other has some ground in reality. Although it might be
in fact, I think
an extremist explanation.
Well, I think you put your finger on it. Hallucinations are a large part of insanity.
My guest is Norman Mailer. His new book is called Oswald's Tale: An American Mystery. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Norman Mailer. His new book is about Lee Harvey Oswald. I asked him if he's been thinking about extremism and if he sees any connection between the American fringe of obsessive conspiracy theorists and the anti-government fringe allegedly behind the bombing in Oklahoma City.
Well, I think you're making a very large jump there that has no foundation at all for one very simple reason. Most of the people who are conspiratorialists, who believe that there was a good deal behind the Kennedy assassination that's never come to light, tend to be of the left. And obviously, the ultra-patriots who went in for the terrorist actions in Oklahoma City are of the far right. So to begin with, there's no tie at all, unless you're going to argue that the far left and the far right come together, which takes a great deal of talking about because there's very little basis for that. So the difference is, on the one hand, these are people who the conspiratorialists want to solve a mystery, and a terrorist wants to create mystery. So they're at opposite poles. It's the difference between scholars, if you will, and athletes or criminals or people who are people who create violent action. The conspiratorialists are not plotting to blow up buildings. They're plotting to, if you will, they're seeking to find out what was done in the government that was not legitimate.
It seems to me that conspiracy theories, a conspiratorial point of view, is so much a part of the American fringe.
No, that's your assumption. It's just not true. How many conspiratorialists have you met? Have you met any of them ever? Have you talked to any of them ever? They're not part of a fringe. They're perfectly intelligent, reasonable people. A good many of them are academics. This is a notion to just sweep them into the corner and say they're all silly and they don't amount to anything.
No, but I'm talking about... Maybe I should just ask you straightforwardly like this. I'm sure you've been following the bombing of Oklahoma City.
Yes.
And I wonder what you've been making of what we've been learning about the extremist militias and the paranoid thinking about the government that lies behind, or that seems now to lie behind, the bombing.
Well, I've been saying from the beginning that this news is at its worst for Newt Gingrich. He's going to suffer more from this than anyone else because Newt Gingrich has been building a notion that the world's going to be saved through technology. He's looking to a brave new future. He's a Tufflerite. He believes in the third wave, the fourth wave, and all that stuff. And what this dramatizes for me is that we're never going to have our human problems solved through technology, because technology and terrorism are umbilically related. You can't have one without the other. And it's going to increase. In other words, the more technology takes over our lives, so the more will terrorism take over our lives, because ultimately it's the reaction of people who feel they're being surrounded. When you have these ultra-right-wing terrorists talking about how the government is impinging on their lives, I think what they're really saying is technology is impinging on their lives. They're not really able to, it's as if you're not almost able to breathe anymore in the way you want to breathe. Well, people tend to assume that's the fault of the government. In fact, if they're going to look for someone who should bear the blame, it's the fault of the second government. The first government is the federal government, which has any number of good and ugly aspects to it. But there's a second government, which is as loose a congeries of associations as the first government, and that second government is the American corporation, which is taking over much more of our lives in a way through their advertising than the Soviets ever succeeded in brainwashing their people, because Soviet brainwashing was terribly crude and ugly and assertive and overbearing, and most people saw through it. Whereas American advertising is enormously successful, and it brainwashes us all the time. It impinges on us constantly. And I think that one of the ironies of the ultra-right wingers is that what they don't understand is that their real enemy is probably not the federal government so much as the second government, the corporate government, that affects our lives constantly.
You've lived through and written about the surveillance of the left in the days of the anti-Vietnam War movement. Now there's a call for new anti-terrorist laws that would enable the FBI to conduct a more thorough surveillance of extremist groups that are a threat to American people. And I'm wondering what your reaction to those proposed laws is.
You can't answer these things in 1 minute or 2 minutes. You can't say, oh, these laws are very bad, or they're very good, or they're necessary, or I regret them, but they have to be done. The fact of the matter is that the country's in very bad shape. You wouldn't have... What is shocking about this terrorist activity is these people are ultra-right-wing patriots. Now, since when do patriots go around killing children? It's not patriotic and American to go around blowing up children. It's exactly the opposite of what a patriot would claim to be. A patriot would claim to be for flag and family and country and the protection of children. So obviously we've gotten into a situation where the extremes have gone beyond themselves, and we're dealing with a new kind of extreme, which is why everyone in America is so desperately shocked over all this.
Norman Mailer is my guest. His new book is called Oswald's Tale, An American History. It's about Lee Harvey Oswald. You worked with Lawrence Schiller on your new Oswald book, and you also worked with him on The Executioner's Song about Gary Gilmore. He has a bestseller now. He co-wrote with O.J. Simpson the bestseller I Want to Tell You.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder your impressions of that book. Have you read the book? And
Yeah, but I'm not going to talk about it because Larry's my colleague, and I don't want to get into what's good about the book and what I don't like in the book because it's just not relevant to why I'm here.
I wonder, too... Maybe you wouldn't want to talk about this, what you think about his style of journalism, if you see him practicing a style of exploitive journalism. Or,
listen, everything you say is so loaded that we're having trouble having a conversation.
All right.
I mean, he's my friend. Everything he does is not so loaded. He was doing a job, and I don't want to get into this.
Okay. Have you been following the O.J. Simpson trial?
The way everyone else is, it's become part of my...
Well, I don't know what that means. Some people are really glued to it, and other people aren't following it at all, so...
Well, there are a lot of people in the middle who are just sort of following it because they can't think of anything better to do at 11:30 at night, so they turn it on.
So that's
I'm one of those in the middle. I'm not fascinated with the case. I'm depressed by the case. But I have enough curiosity, so I'll turn it on from time to time.
What do you mean?
I think it's a desperately bad case for America.
What do you mean?
It's bad for black and white relations, mm-hmm. relations between blacks and whites, because no matter how it turns out, whether he's acquitted, whether there's a hung jury, or he's found guilty, black and white relations are going to be worse after it's over. Because on the one hand, whites are going to be infuriated, and on the other hand, blacks are going to be infuriated, and if it's a hung jury, everyone's going to be disgusted with the law system, with the law courts.
Norman Mailer is my guest. Why now? Why did you decide to write about Oswald now?
Because Larry Schiller came to me and said, I have access to the KGB file on Oswald. Are you interested? We'd worked together before. I enjoyed working with him. I wanted to work with him again.
What kind of style were the files written in?
Bureaucratic style. It's in the book. If you take a look in the book, you'll see the style.
I thought maybe you could explain, you know, describe it for our listeners.
Well, let people read the book. Let them have some curiosity.
There's plenty to read, hundreds and hundreds of pages.
Well, incidentally, I want to ask you a question. Why do people have such a horror of a long book? I mean, does everything have to be the length of the bridges of Madison County?
Why do people have such a horror of a long book? There are a lot of books that I personally feel could have used better editing. That with more time and more concise way could have been found to say what's
been
said.
I know, but then what you get into is bottom lining. Thomas Mann, who was probably the greatest German novelist of the 20th century, once said, only the exhaustive is truly interesting. And the virtue of a long book is you finally have an experience that you don't have in a short book. Books have many virtues, but they don't have all of them.
I agree, but I guess what I'm saying is the opposite in a way that sometimes with more time and more thought, a more distilled book, and I'm not saying this about your book, but just about a lot of long books in general, sometimes more time into a book would create a more distilled book.
Well, my feeling is that this book is 800 pages, and if I hadn't put in that time, it would have been 1,500 pages. I did distill it. There was a mountain of material, and I wanted to reduce it to the point where it would be highly readable for 800 pages. Now, whether I succeeded or not is for the reader to decide. But when you ask me, for instance, about what was the KGB style of writing like, it's very hard to describe a style of writing to people. It's much easier for them to take a look at the style and decide for themselves. You know, the KGB style was roughly simple, bureaucratic, to the point, not terribly interested in nuance. What made the files fascinating were the transcripts of marital quarrels between Oswald and Marina. That was fascinating stuff because, my God, they behaved like every couple, every young couple you've ever encountered, if you've ever heard them having a fight. They argued over who washed the floors. It was wonderful. You know, the argument would go sort of, what do you mean that you washed the floor? You have washed the floor one time. I have washed the floor 21 times. Now, you know, it was universal.
I feel like in many ways you've been writing about the American personality from a lot of different directions.
Yes.
From, you know, between writing about American politics and the American anti-war movement of the 60s and writing about Oswald and writing about some American criminals like Michael Gilmore.
No, you mean...
Like Ari Gilmore. Forgive me.
You're in trouble.
Yeah, I'm in trouble. And I'm wondering if now... you're thinking a lot about America and America's extremes and between the O.J. Simpson trial and the terrorist bombing in Oklahoma City. I wonder if you feel like you're following that with a novelist's eye and, you know, with a writer's eye, or whether that's you're just too busy to focus on that now.
You mean on Oklahoma City?
Mm-hmm.
I'm just appalled by it. You know, I think I'm reacting like an average American to that event. It depresses me profoundly because terrorism is horrible enough when the aim is to create disruption and kill a few people. But when you start killing 100 or more people and in the course of destroying half a building, obviously we're getting into something that's going to change the very nature of modern life. Before it's all over, we'll all be living in fortresses. The fear of walking the streets is so great already, this is going to aggravate everything that's bad in American life. I really think it's the spiritual fruit of Vietnam. Years ago I wrote that that the worst thing about Vietnam is that it was going to encourage every horror in American life to rise from its sewer. To come up out of the sewer, and that's exactly what's happening. America used to be a relatively free and easy country to compare to what it is now, and it's going to get worse and worse and worse. So long before I can be a novelist, I'm just reacting to it as someone who just says, oh my Lord, the life my children lead is going to be much worse than my own life.
Is there anything that you could say ties together your body of work in terms of the subject matter that interests you?
Well, I think you said it. I'm interested in American life. I've written about it from a dozen different angles. I find America endlessly interesting, or I have all through my working life. And so, I'm not at all an international writer or a cosmopolitan writer. America is what interests and fascinates me. And with the exception of one book I wrote about ancient Egypt, everything I've written has been about America. I just find it such a curious country and with so many aspects and so many sides and changing all the time that... I never get tired of writing about it.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you, Terry Gross.
Norman Mailer's new book is called Oswald's Tale, An American Mystery. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Cagney and Lacey, the hit TV cop series of the 80s, featured two women as its main characters. In addition to solving cases on the streets, the two detectives also battled chauvinism in the office. Coming up, we'll talk with the stars of Cagney and Lacey, Sharon Gless and Tyne Daly. They'll be reunited Tuesday in a CBS movie called Cagney and Lacey Together Again. Also, linguist Jeff Nunberg looks at people who have had the sometimes dubious honor of having things named after them. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The death toll from the federal building bombing in Oklahoma City is past 100. The city's fire chief says more bodies were found today where floors were pancaked on top of each other. The fire chief won't speculate how much longer the search for bodies will take. Attorney General Janet Reno says she supports the president's new counterterrorism proposals, but she says she doubts they could have prevented the Oklahoma City bombing.
We see no indication that these tools would have helped us avoid it, but what we have got to do is to make sure that we pursue every lead, that we are advised of those leads as soon as possible so that we can make appropriate determinations and analyze what we're getting from around the country.
Reno joined the FBI in saying the Justice Department has no evidence of a diary that reportedly named three bombing suspects. The reported indicate two more attacks similar to the Oklahoma bombing were considered and rejected. The FBI says it has no such diary. The FBI has released the text of a second letter from the so-called Unabomber that was mailed to one of his victims. The New York Times published another letter yesterday by the serial bomber, whose attacks have killed three people and injured 22 others over the last 17 years. NPR's Anthony Brooks reports.
The letter was sent to Yale University computer scientist David Gelernter, seriously injured in a letter bomb attack 2 years ago. It taunts the professor, calling him a techno-nerd, criticizing his work with computers and writing, "People with advanced degrees aren't as smart as they think they are." Yesterday, the New York Times published another letter in which the bomber claimed to represent an anarchist group and offered to end the bombings if the Times publishes a lengthy manuscript. FBI agent Rick Smith calls both letters significant.
What we had looked at before, where it was merely the Unabomber suspect's behavior, now we're looking at, for the first time, we're looking at his motivation.
Investigators doubt the string of 16 Unabomber attacks is the work of a group and are looking for a single white male who was spotted once in 1987. This is Anthony Brooks reporting.
Flight attendants working for Delta have filed a lawsuit over the air carrier's weight restriction. Bruce Dorton reports.
The lawsuit is an effort to ban the Atlanta-based airline from limiting the weight of flight attendants. It was filed in U.S. District Court in Atlanta. The Equal Employment Opportunity Commission called the weight limit practice discriminatory in a January ruling. One of the attendants who filed the suit, Terry Racelet, still works for Delta, but she says she acquired an eating disorder while trying to avoid being fired under the weight limits. She says attendants have not been weighed since 1992 when Delta placed a moratorium on the practice, but she said they haven't promised no one will ever be weighed again. Delta spokesman Todd Clay says the airline's weight policy was not discriminatory. For National Public Radio, I'm Bruce Dorton in Atlanta.
On Wall Street, the stock market set a new record today. The Wall Street gained nearly 15 points to close at 4,314. This is NPR. This is Holocaust Remembrance Day. It is the 50th anniversary of the defeat of the Nazis. The BBC's Jonathan Burchell reports the anniversary is an annual day of mourning in Israel.
For 2 minutes every year, Israel comes to a halt on this day to commemorate those who died in Europe. At the Yad Vashem Holocaust Memorial in the city, Israel's President Ezer Weizmann and Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin took part in wreath-laying ceremonies. Throughout the day at Yad Vashem, families are reading out the names of relatives who died under the Nazis, part of an effort to mark the death of each individual victim. This year, the speeches and ceremonies have focused in particular on the 50th anniversary of the end of the war in Europe and the liberation of the camps. Prime Minister Rabin last night thanked the Allies and their armies, who he said had belatedly opened the doors of hell and brought about the day of redemption.
Jonathan Burchell reporting. Hundreds of Japanese police searched a commune belonging to the mysterious Japanese sect suspected in Tokyo gassing attacks. They're still looking for the sect's leader, Shoko Asahara. He has been in hiding since the March 20th nerve gassing of the Tokyo subway, when 12 people died. Authorities took two of the sect's main scientists into custody yesterday in a secret basement they found underneath the sect dormitory. That led them to hope that they would find Asahara, too. Sect leaders have repeatedly denied any connection with a gassing attack, but daily raids at a main site have turned up tons of chemicals that could have been used to make the nerve gas. Ministers representing 97 non-aligned countries ended a meeting in Indonesia today without agreement on the nuclear non-proliferation agreement. The Indonesian foreign minister says the countries decided in the end not to find a common position. The three-day session of the non-aligned movement was also unable to agree on whether the veto power of the five permanent members of the UN Security Council should be abolished. I'm Korva Coleman, National Public Radio News from Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Cagney and Lacey are reunited in a made-for-TV movie that airs Tuesday night on CBS. The TV series, which ran from 1982 to 88, was perhaps the first series to make an attempt to realistically deal with the lives of women cops. My guests Sharon Glass and Tyne Daly starred in the series. After the series ended, Tyne Daly starred in the Broadway revival of Gypsy. Sharon Glass married one of the creators of Cagney and Lacey, Barney Rosenzweig, and collaborated with him on another series, The Trials of Rosie O'Neill. Tuesday night's movie is the second of four planned reunion films. Christine Cagney, played by Glass, is now a lieutenant frustrated by her desk job. Mary Beth Lacey, played by Daly, has returned to the force after retiring because her husband, Harv, has had a heart attack and is unable to work. Lacey wants to take on the case of a homeless man who she thinks has been falsely accused of murder.
Christine, you have to help me with this Chance Tucker thing.
Mary Beth, you already turned the information over to Feldberg. He says that the local precinct will look into it.
They already have a suspect. It's going to end up at the bottom of the pile. Chris, I want to do this with you.
He's already given you another assignment.
It's another list to compile. I will do it at night if you help me with this here.
Mary Beth, I went and I talked to the clerk at the liquor store.
When?
Last night. Thought it was worth another look.
And?
And he hinted that maybe Tucker was telling the truth.
You see? Now you put that together with the theft from the sports car.
Assuming it's even the same car, you can't prove anything. All you've got is suspicions about one guy and a wink and a nod from another.
I think before Cagney and Lacey, the TV shows that had women cops were Charlie's Angels, in which that show was as much about glamour as anything else, and Get Christy Love, and then Police Woman, which starred Angie Dickinson. Mm-hmm. When you started the series, what did you want to do different from the women cops of earlier shows?
Well, I don't dishonor those shows because I do think that they made an attempt to do something. You know, we're all of us products of our time frame, and in the time frame, they were, in fact, allowing women to be at the helm of shows. So I can't despise them at all. Without those four mothers, as the women's movement is fond of saying, there wouldn't have been us in some ways. But we certainly were really interested in talking about women who do not wear high heels to run around the streets after bad guys, who actually have the smarts to change into their tennies to go home on the subway even, much less to chase after perpetrators.
Was there ever any pressure on you both from outside or inside, or pressure on the writers, to make the characters more glamorous?
Sure. There was lots of pressure from all sorts of places. There's pressure on women in this society to be more glamorous no matter what they do, but certainly on actresses.
I used to be very offended by people saying, well, are you going to be feminizing the show? And I said, no. I mean, it's already a feminine show. It starts two
we
women.
We are females. Here we are.
Right. So I went out of my way, to just make her the woman that she is.
Yeah, there were a lot of real dumb assumptions in terms of the women being strong and friends. There was stuff about lesbianism. There was stuff about not being glamorous enough. There was stuff. But that happens whenever you're trying what's that awful phrase? Push the envelope a little bit.
Mm-hmm. So what were the pressures about being more glamorous? Where did they come from?
what was said.
Jeez, that's a long time ago.
I never got any direct pressure from any network, and certainly not from Barney. Just when I would be given interviews, I would be asked, so are you going to make the show more feminine? Are you?
I know. We hired new costume people that second season, you know, that were supposed to upgrade the clothes. There was, you know, supposedly more attention. I had to
Oh, they did cut bangs on me.
Okay, right. I had to.
What was that supposed to do?
I don't know, soften me, I guess.
I had to beat the hairdresser away, you know, and said, tell her just to leave me alone, because Mary Beth hadn't seen the back of her own hair in 15 years. And I didn't want to be constantly fluffed in terms of this very busy, very tired lady. Stuff like that.
Yeah, and Mary Beth was hardly a very fashion-conscious character.
No.
So, I mean, that's the way she should have been.
Yeah.
But were you told she should be dressing better for the audience?
They brought in all these clothes, you know, and then you have to fight about what to wear and what not to wear. It's all about image, and we were trying to get inside these women. But there was, I felt there was, in those days, if I go back, there was a lot of discussion about how they looked and what they ought to look like.
A few years into it, I was taken shopping and told to get a better bra. and to start wearing sort of slinkier clothes.
What was wrong with your other bra?
I got a better bra. they decided I wasn't high enough. But I let them buy the clothes, and then I didn't wear them.
What was it like for you both to learn how to carry a gun for the series?
Different experience. I was very nervous about it. When I first was invited to play Cagney, or when I first came to play Cagney, I was sent to the police academy for training, and Tyne showed up, really just, I think, for support.
No,
she'd
I was
gone
cleaning up.
It.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Anyway, so there we were out on the target practice, and they had blanks in it, and I was doing, you know, so-so. And then they took the blanks out and put real bullets in. And I just lost it. I really got very, very frightened. Tears started rolling down my face. I was shaking. I just hate guns. But I looked over at Tyne, and she had her bullets in, and she was getting pretty close to the bullseye. And all of a sudden, I got very competitive. I said, wait a minute. This Cagney's not a wuss. Wait a minute. So I started popping them off, but I never had been comfortable ever carrying the gun. When I needed to feel the weight in my purse, I would carry small cans of tomato juice. It got to be sort of a joke with us. And the only time I would actually carry the gun, because our guns that you saw us with were actual real guns that did work. If I had to carry it on me, like in a strap across my chest or in my belt, I would then do it. But otherwise, it was always in the prop man's hands.
My guests are Sharon Gless and Tyne Daly. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Sharon Gless and Tyne Daly. They're reunited in a CBS movie called Cagney and Lacey, Together Again. It airs Tuesday night. Did you talk with women cops before you started the series?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Who'd you seek out? Where did you go?
I used just the women that they provided for us on the set. We had technical advisors. And it was fascinating to me to hear the stories when I was first there. I remember it was like my first day on the set, and I don't remember who the technical advisor was.
It's that very short blonde woman. She was wonderful. She was from California.
Right.
And she had six kids, and she'd been married twice, both time to cops.
Right.
And she was our first TA, and I can't recall her name either, which is too bad. But she was an interesting woman.
I was worried the fact that we were playing non-traditional roles, and it was in a man's world. And I remember I asked her, is it all right to show feelings in these characters?
And she said no. She said if you're standing over a dead body and you quiver and shake and throw up, they're going to not respect you, and you can't do it. You got to hold on to yourself.
Right.
Did you talk to a lot of women cops after the series was established and get a sense of what they thought of the characters and of the show?
They contacted us.
Yeah.
But
I would like to say, by the by, I also talked to a lot of men cops.
What's the range of response you heard from cops about the show?
Mostly positive, that I remember.
I think that people don't trouble too often unless they're very upset to tell you what they hate about it. Yeah. I mean, we got a lot of appreciative mail all around, you know.
The most frightening is when you get mail from young women or young girls who say, I love your show, and I'm just out of high school, and I've just enrolled. I'm going on the force. You know, you want to write them back and say, look, you can get killed. This is just a dramatization. But
however, chances are if they're not made for it and they go through the academy, they'll either do it or they'll get weeded out. But it does feel like a huge responsibility to have the young saying, I'd like to follow in your footsteps as a cop. And you want to say, darling, I'm an actress.
Right.
I know nothing about being a cop.
Right.
You know, if you want to talk about my profession and go into my profession, that's a whole other discussion.
Right.
Well, I guess that made you think twice about doing anything that would glamorize police work.
My intention was to do a lot of sitting in front of the typewriter filling out reports. And because
that's
the boring part of the job, the stuff that's just routine is so huge. And we were allowed to do that in a way that a glamorous male star who has to uphold the fantasy of what cop life is like is not obliged to do. It wasn't until a little bit later that we start getting your Hill Street Blues and your LA Laws and stuff like that when we look a little bit of how it really goes. But still, we had a couple of gunfights, but they were rare. Because if you pull that weapon in real life and to shoot somebody, you're going to have to fill out reports in triplicates about why you did it and where the thing landed and how come you used two bullets instead of one.
We also were told that as often as you see guns being pulled on television by people who play cops, that they don't do that.
In a given
they don't
career.
Pull that gun unless they mean to use it.
Tyne Daly, were you pregnant in real life when your character was pregnant in the series?
I sure was.
Very.
I got pregnant shortly after we shut down one season, and
at Christmas
I fessed up to my boss, thinking I'd get fired and then I could get some rest. But he immediately said, "Okay, we put it in the show," and we geared up and went back to work after being down for what, only a month or five
weeks? He called me in Toronto, where I was shooting with John Ritter, and said, "You have to come home immediately."
Yes.
I said, "I'm here. I'm doing a show." He says, "Well, you have to come back." Hey, Barney, I'm doing this for 5 weeks, you know. Well, as soon as you finish.
Did the writers have to find out what real police policies were in different parts of the country about women being pregnant on the job?
Sure. Sure.
Just in New York, really.
Well, no, Regis in New York, right.
Yeah, I mean,
we did a show
came
on
the
that.
Place. It came the we did a show where Chris had to tell Mary Beth
she had to leave.
She had to go home. Time to go.
Sharon Glass, did you want the series to end?
When it ended,
yeah.
By that time, I was ready. Hell, I was in rehab when it ended.
were you?
Yeah, I was at Hazleton when I got the news. And I thought, it's best. It's fine. I need a rest. I need a break. I noticed there was, when it was time to go back, you know, when that time, whenever it is you go back to do your series again, when that time rolled around, I remember sort of feeling an emptiness. Gosh, this is when I'd be doing this. But I was glad. I felt we'd all done wonderful, wonderful work. I'd made a friend for life. I fell in love with the producer, which was good news and bad news. all kinds of things happened, so I went away with many things. But when the end came, it was okay.
Let me ask you, was there any connection between your characters' drinking problem and your own time in rehab?
No. I don't believe that. I didn't even think that I had a problem until a year after Cagney had sobered up.
That's funny, because Cagney never thought she had a problem.
Well, that's true.
I guess you didn't learn anything.
There may be
from
some
that.
some level on which I actually, the doctor that I interviewed with about what I should do and do I have a problem, blah, blah, said, I thought, he said, when you were playing Cagney, he said, I thought you were sober. I thought that you, I mean, I was sober when I shot it, but he said, I thought you had already been in rehab and knew exactly how to play an alcoholic. And I said, well, that was me just acting. He said, well, very impressive. He said, thank you. Because I wasn't that good where I could drink on the set. I wouldn't remember my lines, and that particular two-parter had a lot of monologues in them. So anyway. No, I don't relate between the two. She was one person and I was another.
It's sort of the same thing as having a real baby and then having a pretend baby.
Mm-hmm.
When I got back from having Alexandra, Mary Beth had to be pregnant. That pregnancy went on for, I don't know, 13, 14
yeah.
months. And then there came the birthing scene, you know, and everybody sort of assumed that because I'd just done some birthing and, you know, I'd done it before, I had three kids and stuff like that, that I would be drawing on my experience in life to play out this stuff that Mary Beth was going through in terms of her pregnancy. But indeed, the mind does something for you. I couldn't remember a thing about birthing Alexandra while I was birthing the imaginary Alice. You draw on some experience, but there's a place where the characters, unless you're insane, there's a place where the characters diverge from each other. If you are actually doing, stealing your entire life to apply to the character, I think you're certifiable.
Yeah, exactly. The truth is, when Charlie Cagney died, my father really was dying in a hospital, and never once did I ever use it. Well, ever, ever. Huh.
It's too hard to use, too close to use.
Yeah.
It's too precious. That's your mm-hmm. that's your life.
And there is enough power between, with my feelings for Christine and her feelings for her dad. It was enough.
Mm-hmm. So you've got the Cagney and Lacey movie coming up. You're shooting another one now that will be...
We're shooting two more.
So there's a total of four.
Right.
And any more Cagney and Lacey plans after that?
Not right now.
No, but I'm open.
Okay.
There's still two of the best parts... There are for women on television, yeah. so it's fun.
Tyne Daly and Sharon Gless star in the movie Cagney and Lacey Together Again, Tuesday night on CBS. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what do you have on today's Senate Judiciary Committee hearings on proposed anti-terrorist measures?
Well, we'll be hearing about testimony, including that of Louis Free, the director of the FBI, who talked about the dangers to the country from groups that are arming themselves against law enforcement agencies, and that he called for a greater intelligence effort against them. Also on today's program, we'll be hearing the latest in the investigation of the Oklahoma City bombing. We'll be hearing about observances of Yom HaShoah, that's Hebrew for the Day of the Holocaust, and a look back on the South African elections a year ago.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. If you've ever wondered how the noun Luddite came into being, listen as linguist Jeff Nunberg tells us about some of the people whose names have become common nouns.
The Roman philosopher Boethius wrote that every man dies two deaths, the first of his body, the second of his fame. I guess most of us are lucky if that second death is put off for a full day, just long enough for our names to appear on the only page of the newspaper where the headlines are written in the past tense. Wolf J. Flywheel, 82, headed law enforcement agency. But occasionally, fate makes a special deal with some people that lets their names live on even after their fame has subsided. They don't have to sell their souls, just give up their capital letters and live on as common nouns. Take Charles C. Boycott, the 19th century Irishman who was the first victim of a new kind of commercial embargo. Historians have no reason to remember his name, but the etymologists are still keeping track of it. Likewise, Charles Lynch, the Virginia magistrate known for administering a sort of rough and ready justice that came to be called Lynch Law. Or take my favorite of all, Frau Bertha Krupp von Bohlen und Halbach, who gave her name to the piece of artillery that was the original Big Bertha. Sometimes a name comes down to us through a whole series of forgettings. Take Ned Ludd. The first bearer of that name was a fellow even less memorable than Boycott or Lynch. As the story goes, he was a feeble-minded workman who lived in a small town in Leicestershire at the end of the 18th century. It happened that one day he chased some boys who were tormenting him into a house where some frames used in stocking manufacture were kept. Unable to catch the boys, he vented his anger on the frames. Afterwards, whenever machinery was broken, it became a local joke to say that Ned Ludd had done it. The joke might have died out soon enough, But about 20 years later, when a band of Nottingham craftsmen took to breaking up machinery in a systematic way, their leader took the name of General Ludd, and his followers became known as Luddites, a name that spread, along with the movement, to other parts of the English Midlands. Here's where we come to the second forgetting. The modern myth holds that the Luddites were simply rioters who smashed the machinery in the vain belief that they could somehow hold back the tide of industrialization. And ever since then, people have invoked the word when they want to suggest an irrational resistance to technological change. It's got to the point where you can't criticize any technological development without first abjuring any Luddite intentions. I'm no Luddite, but it's become the loyalty oath of the Republic of Progress. The thing of it is that the Luddites were no Luddites either. It's true they destroyed machinery that enabled mill owners to replace them with women and children who worked 16-hour days for subsistence wages. This at a time when national unemployment was over 30% and poor relief was being drastically reduced. But what drove them to open rebellion was a series of legal measures that had stripped away their right to organize and eliminated the minimum wage. And even then, they were selective in their destruction. They spared the machines of mill owners who hadn't lowered their wages or who compensated men put out of work. The Luddites won some temporary victories in places like Nottingham, where the minimum wage was restored. But in the end, the movement was doomed when the full power of the state was arrayed against it. Parliament made the destruction of machinery a capital crime over the eloquent objections of Lord Byron. 12,000 troops were sent to the Midlands, more than Wellington had with him in the campaign against Napoleon. Some of the Luddites finished on the gallows, the rest went underground. Their story was rewritten as a lesson about the futility of trying to stand in the way of technological change. Of course, it's always been the victors who wrote the history books, but this time they wrote the dictionaries, too.
Jeffrey Nunberg is a linguist at Stanford University and the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Roberta Shurrock, with Nancy Updike and Barbara Bogave. Research assistance from Becky Cohen. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from Random House, publisher of Dr. Seuss and Mr. Geisel, a biography by Judith and Neil Morgan. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next archive edition of Fresh Air, we mark the 20th anniversary of the fall of Saigon. We'll hear from novelists and journalists who were in Vietnam. Also, we remember Grey Panther founder Maggie Kuhn, who died last week. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.